6 foot 6 above sea level. And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. With me here in the studios is a fairly regular guest on this program, Matt Rothschild. Matt is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, writes on an incessant basis almost daily on various sites, especially for the WDC. His opinion pieces have run in the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, the Miami Herald, and a host of other newspapers. On occasion, he's appeared on Nightline, National Public Radio, C-SPAN, and he was even on with Bill O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Factor once, and was quoted as saying that it was an extreme act of masochism. Matt Rothschild, my friend, I thought we'd have a kind of freewheeling conversation. Matt, welcome.
Thanks, Al. I'm usually not into masochism, but yeah, O'Reilly, not a lot of fun.
Let's start, you know, hope to get to some state politics after a bit, but I thought we'd start today with Donald Trump. That is, last night there was this commander-in-chief forum, a kind of, I don't know, gala for the military, I guess. But we could talk about that a little bit. He came out with some weird stuff. But I think there's a deeper question that we don't explore enough, because at some level, Donald Trump, in my estimation, is a symptom of broader things going on in the country, a malaise, anxiety, and so on and so forth. But there's this question now, of course, if you look at the opinion polls, the fact that the point spreads between he and Hillary Clinton have actually narrowed, and in some areas, in some segments of the population, he's certainly leading. You know, it's this margin of error stuff all over the place. What does it mean that half the country seems to be ready to vote for Donald Trump?
Well, that's exactly the question I've been asking myself, and it's a scary question, actually, because he's up 2 points among likely voters in the CNN poll. It's possible that Trump would be our next president, and that is exactly the question I think to ask both of me and of your listeners, Alan, because what troubles me about Trump is a whole range of things. One, I do think he has fascist overtones, and certainly his racism about Mexicans, his racism about Muslims, his anti-intellectualism, his America First-ism are echoes of fascism. Actually, on NPR, they did a show before one of Trump's foreign policy speeches a while ago, and they went through the whole program on America First without mentioning that it was actually a fascist program in the 1930s. They just called it a anti-war movement, as though it was an anti-war movement comparable to the anti-war movement in the 60s, which almost made me drive off the road and crash. But Trump is quite explicitly echoing America First. He uses it in every speech almost, and he is appealing to some of those same forces. So even if he loses, Trumpism won't be lost. I mean, this is a phenomenon, an ideology in a way that he is appealing to. And so the thing that I'm wrestling with is, what percentage of those voters who are for Trump right now are just always Republican voters and going to vote Republican no matter who it is? Because Sarah Palin, for instance, when she was running for president, she was polled early on last time around at about 42 or 43% against any Democrat. So that may just be the floor out there for Republican candidate X. But there are some Republicans who aren't going to vote for Trump right now. And I think there are a lot of Republican women who are intelligent, and some intelligent, moderate Republican men, which is a increasingly extinct species, I suppose, going extinct species. But some of those aren't going to vote for Trump. But here we have him neck and neck. And so I think it suggests a lot of things. One, there is great discontent in this country with politics as usual and politicians as usual. In part, that was reflected in Bernie Sanders' appeal. authenticity, not a regular politician, and Hillary Clinton represents politics as usual and politicians as usual, with the obvious exception and not insignificant one that she's a woman and would be the first woman president. But Trump is appealing to people who are just fed up. And there are a lot of people who are fed up with politics and politicians and fed up with their lot in life and realize that they don't have power. He talks about giving them, representing them. He's the voice of them. You know, he tells people, you've got no power, vote for me. I will be your power and your voice. That's kind of a fascist appeal, too. Quite in contrast with Sanders, by the way, who said, vote for me and I need you in the streets. I can't do it alone.
You know, you mentioned, of course, that Trump in you know, just recently has been raising this old slogan of America first, which you're definitely accurate. You're correct that in the 20s, 30s, it was a slogan raised by the far right, the fascist right, really.
I mean, there was an America's First rally in New York City in Madison Square Garden with a huge Nazi flag in 1937.
Well, that was a Bund yeah. rally, Nazi Bund. But interestingly, he's also, yesterday he raised in two speeches the other slogan of the more recent right of peace through strength that came about in the early 80s around the whole atomic freeze campaign and so on, with the right wing saying, no, heck no, we got to our peace through strength, that we prepare for war in order to maintain peace. That marvelous Orwellian formulation.
Yeah, it was a big Reagan slogan early on, which he kind of abandoned in Reykjavik when he was ready to get rid of nuclear weapons. That was a possibility that was fascinating and didn't quite happen. We'd be safer if it did. And I see that President Obama, speaking out of both sides of his mouth, wants to get rid of nuclear weapons and is modernizing our nuclear arsenal and won't take the weapons off of hair trigger alert even, which is just crazy. Here we are, you know, 20, 25 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. But you've got Trump with Russia now. That's an interesting thing. You know, his fascination with Putin. I mean, you can laugh and say it's one authoritarian figure admiring another. On the other hand, I think Trump is right about NATO. There's no reason for NATO to exist right now. And I know he was criticized.
Oh, yeah, he doesn't say that it shouldn't exist. He's saying now that the other junior partners of NATO have to pay up, have to ante right. up, that there are arrears in their payment. And, you know, and a lot of folks, you know, misunderstand NATO, that it's basically been a U.S. command
right.
Since its inception, basically.
Well, and certainly since the fall of the Soviet Union, I mean, it's been a wing of U.S. imperial wars. Before the fall of the Soviet Union, I mean, after the fall of the Soviet Union, it's been that. Before the fall of the Soviet Union, it was a first strike doctrine, which is to say if the Soviet Union put a toe into any country in Western Europe, nuclear war would ensue. The United States would just launch a nuclear war. And so I don't view NATO as having any legitimate reason to live right now. So when Trump, you know, suggested a while ago, well, he's not so fond of NATO, or maybe these countries should pay up, that didn't trouble me so much. And there was a MoveOn.org ad saying, don't vote for Trump because he's against NATO. And it's that kind of knee-jerkism that I think doesn't help in the long run here. I mean, you can be against Trump for a whole variety of legitimate reasons and scared to death of him. I'm scared to death of him. But not say, you know, we should... We should stay in NATO. That's what we've got to do as progressives or liberals or Democrats or leftists or whoever you want to define yourself. I mean, NATO shouldn't be around. A first strike doctrine shouldn't be around.
You're listening to Matt Rothschild with the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and columnist, commentator on all things political, national, local, state. You know, yesterday... Before this event, you know, back-to-back Clinton-Trump appearances last night, the Trump also called for a vast expansion of the military, 90,000 new soldiers for the Army, increasing the number of Marine battalions from 24 to 36, 75 new ships for the Navy, which, of course, would entail a $90 billion a year additional spending to the military budget. And his comment about when asked about, well, where's that going to come from? We're going to do away with waste and increase efficiency in the Pentagon and so on. He's also called for the proposed buying of dozens of new fighter aircraft for the Air Force. And, of course, lots of that stuff gets sold abroad.
Well, the U.S. is the biggest arms dealer in the world. But, you know, this combination of militarism and crude patriotism or nationalism that Trump peddles is again, why some people are hearing echoes of a fascist. On the other side, I mean, Hillary Clinton gave a speech a couple of weeks ago about American exceptionalism, where she said, again, I guess it's a requirement for someone running for president of the United States to say, we are the most exceptional country in the world. And then she repeated Madeleine Albright's awful line that we are the indispensable nation. This is very distressing. And actually, she criticized Trump for not stressing how exceptional the United States is. Yeah.
See, that exceptionalism is important in regard to foreign policy because underlying it, of course, is this whole notion that as the exceptional nation, the American mission must be projected outward, right? That it must be carried to enlighten and liberate and democratize and bring freedom to the rest of the world, following, of course, the American example. And that's where it gets really dodgy.
Well, and it gets really dark when Trump uses exceptionalism as a way to say, you know, the rules don't apply to us and, you know, we're going to torture people. We're going to torture their brothers and sisters and cousins. As though the CIA has never done that, but I haven't seen a presidential candidate who would say that out loud before. And that's grotesque and horrifying, too, that he would go, you know, he doesn't think waterboarding is good enough or bad enough, if you will.
You know, you have to. I want to come back to this, the undercurrents here. Why is it that it's not just, you know, a lot of people are uneasy with lack of confidence in Hillary Clinton. But there's also this kind of right-wing poll that Trump and et cetera have created. And a lot of it, of course, based on when they talk about America first, they're really talking about the white republic.
Well, this is the revenge of white men, what we're seeing here with the Trump phenomenon. And Michael Moore put his finger on it a while ago when he said, you know, here are five reasons why Trump may be the next president. That was one of the biggest ones. A lot of people out there don't like Hillary for the wrong reasons. They don't like her because she's because they're sexist, because she's a strong woman. They don't like strong, smart women. They're intimidated by strong, smart women. There's a feeling out there among many, many people that they're getting screwed. And they are getting screwed. They're getting screwed economically. They're getting screwed by capitalism. They're getting screwed by globalization. They're getting screwed by these free trade agreements. Trump is against the free trade agreements. They don't have people feel they don't have a lot of power in the political system. They're right. They don't have a lot of power because of the problem of money in politics. And Trump also has talked about that. He talked about it in the first Republican debate. I can buy these politicians. Of course, that's blown up in his face now with the attorney general down in Florida. But people understand that at a gut level. And so there's that going on. There's another thing that may not be as powerful, but when politics is turned into a spectator sport, people will vote for the best performer. And Trump is the best performer. I mean, he's different than any politician people have seen before. He's funny because he's unpredictable. You'll sit on your couch and watch him just thinking, what is this guy going to say next? And, you know, so that's kind of a sad commentary, too. I mean, we have been reduced largely to spectators, not entirely, but largely, and the media feed off that. Those are some of the things that are in the mix here, I think.
I commented a while back that Donald Trump really is the first reality TV candidate. And what does reality TV do? You have these people that are actually, in a large part, actors, hired people, who pose as non-actors. They're just average citizens out there performing or carrying out tasks, travails, and so on and so forth. And, of course, he got a national name for himself in large part in the past decade as a reality TV guy.
Telling people they're fired. To some extent, Reagan was a reality TV star, but not in the same way. I mean, he was a TV star and a movie star, but he wasn't, on the screen constantly in front of people just before he was running and doing these ridiculous sadistic role of telling people they're fired.
You know, it's interesting because last night during his part of that commander-in-chief forum, he actually talked about, and he's done it before as well, in front of this audience that was largely comprised of pro-military and military retirees and so on, that he talked about that he would set the agenda in foreign policy in regard to ISIS and other issues, and that he would, yes, consult with generals, but he would get rid of those. You're fired. He talked about how the generals had been reduced to rubble by the recent administrations. And then, of course, turned around off camera yesterday or on a different speech, actually, and talked about this military increase. But he kept waffling about who the role of the generals and how that's all handled.
I mean, this is his narcissism. This is his megalomania. This is his, I'm smarter than the generals. I know more about ISIS than the generals. I mean, the Joint Chiefs and the people in the brass under them watching Trump just must have been losing their dinner last night because he acted as though they haven't been trying to get rid of ISIS before. And he said they've been reduced to rubble, which is ridiculous because, the Joint Chiefs have been more timid about foreign interventions than the president in the last two administrations. I mean, George W. Bush, was consulting with the Joint Chiefs and actually dragging them into the Iraq War. They'd give them plans, but they weren't gung-ho about it. Colin Powell wasn't gung-ho about it even before with Reagan. And then the Joint Chiefs under Obama, they didn't want to do Libya. They didn't want to do Syria and haven't done Syria, but they almost got thrown into that. And so this idea that somehow the Joint Chiefs have been the ones who've been wanting to do more and have been restrained, it's just vice versa.
Our guest today, Matt Rothschild, and talking about the state of the nation, the state of the state. What else do we want to get to on Donald Trump? He already gets enough airtime, I think. That's a whole different discussion. The amount of airtime he gets is incredible.
Well, I mean, that's, our friend Robert McChesney said if Bernie Sanders was covered adequately in the same way that, or even half, or even one-tenth, or one-twentieth of the coverage that Trump got, that, maybe he would have been the nominee. And, of course, if the DNC didn't put their finger on the scale, maybe he would have been the nominee, too. So, the media have a lot to blame for the rise of Donald Trump. Actually, the head of CBS, Les Moonves, told a group of investors a year and a half ago, run, Trump, run, because you're good for our profits. And that was the sick symbiosis that gave rise to Donald Trump in the narrow sense. But the other sick symbiosis or sickening phenomenon anyway was what the Republican Party has been doing the last 30 years in cultivating racism. And now they've got a harvest of racism.
Bob McChesney's absolutely right when he talks about the social and political functions of the media system. That it's not just driven by profits, but there's an ideological agenda quite often that comes down to reproducing the order, the hierarchies in the society, and so on and so forth, to understand news as propaganda.
Yeah, but now they've created this monster and they're kind of freaking out, at least the mainstream print. You had the Dallas Morning News coming out with a strong editorial against Donald Trump. The Washington Post and the New York Times have done the same thing. And I think other papers are going to follow suit. And people are just, beside themselves that we could have this person become president. But I don't think the people who are writing these editorials are really getting out and talking to people. I've met some folks who are voting for Trump and largely white males. Some are kind of in that zone of petty entrepreneurship, where which has traditionally been the base of fascism. You know, a pawn shop owner who's retired, a small farmer, a factory worker actually who's worked for 30 years for the same employee, a woman who is dealing cards at a casino. Is voting for Trump. These may be people who are very conservative in their religious beliefs, which is a weird mix for Trump, too, because he's such a, he's been, married three times now, and he's been all over the place on social issues. So you wouldn't think he'd be perfect for the far right religious social conservatives. But there you have it. I mean, there are, and none of these people are bad people. It's not like these people are goose-stepping and spitting and, making anti-Semitic comments in front of me or racist comments in front of me, even though there are a few of those Trump supporters who do make racist comments, which is kind of appalling. But a lot of the people are good people. And so we have to wrestle with that, too. Good people voting for Trump. What does that mean? And then how do we talk to them? How do we talk to the percentage of people who are voting for Trump, and what percentage of those people are untalkable to? I mean, what percentage of those people are so far right that really you can't have a conversation with them? And I hope it's fewer than 50%, but it's a chunk. I mean, I used to think that the far right in this country was 5 or 10%, and I'm afraid that I was underestimating that by a factor of 3, maybe more.
And I see that we do have a caller that's interested in joining this conversation this hour with Matt Rothschild. Hello, Tom. You're on the air.
Well, hi. I'm curious about Matt's thoughts on the viability of a third party going forward. Speaking of good people voting for dubious candidates, I'm a longtime Democratic voter, but honestly, pretty fed up with both parties. And I realize the old refrain, a vote for Nader is a vote for Bush. But it seems to me to really get past this gridlock that, maybe a third party needs to come to the fore.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, I appreciate the call, too. And this is a subject that I've been thinking about for decades. I think I wrote a cover story for The Progressive in 1989 called Third Party Time. So I'm sympathetic to the impulse that we need a third party, but I'm also chastened by the historical lessons over the last 60 years, and most recently with Ralph Nader, about the viability of third parties. And the United States is structured so heavily against the ability of a third party to enter in that I'm not sure it's going to happen in my lifetime. I understand and appreciate, Tom, you being fed up with both parties and both candidates, for that matter. I never tell people who to vote for. I'm not going to tell people who to vote for now, and I've voted for third parties many times. When I voted not for Bill Clinton when he was running against Bob Dole, there wasn't a lot of meaningful difference there. There may be more of a meaningful difference in some respects this time around, and those are the things that I weigh in my mind. But, yeah, the obstacles to a third party are just so heavy.
It's structured out since the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah, and so, the Socialist Party, the Progressive Party in 1924 in fighting Bob La Follette ran for it, the Progressive Party in 48, the Citizens Party in 1980, Ralph Nader's efforts with the Green Party, they don't go far. And so you just wonder whether that is the best approach, because it doesn't seem to be leading somewhere. And I know my friend Mike McCabe's got this Blue Jean Nation thing he's trying to work here in Wisconsin, which is interesting because he's not saying it's going to be the Blue Jean Party. I mean, maybe it's a Blue Jean movement captures the Democratic Party, for instance. I mean, that's a possibility. That's what the Tea Party's done with the Republican Party, for instance.
Yeah, I said to Mike McCabe, I had him on not long ago on this program, and afterwards I said, you should run for office. He said, yeah. I would, but we don't have a party. We don't have an organization. We don't, and that's a reality as well. Let's switch direction here a little bit. Let's turn our attention, before it gets completely out of hand here, to state politics, the state races. You know, Russ Feingold, as an example, he was at the Labor Temple the other day on Labor Day here in Madison, playing the crowd, he came over to me and he said, shook my hand, and I just leaned into him and I said, kick his butt. And he said, I'm hearing that from everyone. I said, well, what else is there to discuss? What are we going to go to a long disquisition on why you should kick his butt? Yeah, he did. Your thoughts on that? The numbers there, too, are very strange.
Yeah, I'm just very concerned about that. I mean, Ron Johnson, this empty vessel, is within shooting distance of Russ Feingold. I mean, it is just baffling. The state is baffling to me. I mean, I've been here 33 years now, and the schizophrenia in the state is just so astonishing. I mean, the split down the middle between people who are progressive and people who are far right is just amazing. And that Ron Johnson, who's done almost nothing since getting into office and made a fool of himself on multiple occasions, is within striking distance of Russ Feingold is just amazing to me. And it's amazing to me that our governor's rising in the popularity polls. He's now at 43%. And it's just a very strange time. It's a strange time to be an American. It's a strange time to be a badger. It's just a very, it's a very frightening moment. And yet we got to keep going and keep pushing for, our reforms. But this is late capitalism. And we have all these kind of weird phenomenon going on as we see the economy just screwing people over.
We do have a couple of callers that want to get into this conversation with a comment for our guest today, Matt Rothschild. Gil, hey, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I have a couple of issues that I'm curious about Matt's take on, because I know that both he and Jay Heck over at Common Cause have been following the John Doe situation, and I haven't kept track of where that's at right now, if there's something that could happen there at the U.S. Supreme Court level or where things are at there. And then the other question is about the state Supreme Court hearing this open records case concerning Attorney General Schimmel and his training videotapes. There's been some good reporting on it on the hearing that went on, but no real mention of, what prompted this case to begin with was an effort by the Democrats to embarrass Schimmel before he got elected, and whether now the focus seems to be on transparency in general and how transparent the Department of Justice is. So those are just two issues I'm throwing out there. I'd be curious to hear what Matt has to say.
Thanks, Gil.
Hey, Gil, appreciate the call. Yeah, these are two issues I'm following pretty closely, especially the John Doe. So John Doe 2 is still alive. This was the investigation of Walker for allegedly coordinating with outside groups. Actually, his coordination with outside groups isn't in dispute because the state Supreme Court said coordination is legal. They basically gave him a retroactive get-out-of-jail-free card. So what happened was the Wisconsin Supreme Court fired the special prosecutor, Francis Schmitz, and tried to close down the John Doe, but that would leave no one to appeal the decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So Shirley Abramson raised a stink, and the other justices kind of were embarrassed into saying, yeah, I guess we should have our decision be appealable, so we'll let district attorneys join the case. So Ishozan joined the case, and good for him, our DA here in Dane County, as did John Chisholm, the DA in Milwaukee County, and Larry Nelson, the DA in Iowa County. So they have filed a writ of certiorari with the U.S. Supreme Court, which means they want the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case, basically. And here we have Brad Schimmel, Attorney General of the state of Wisconsin, telling the U.S. Supreme Court, don't take the case. Well, I hope they do take the case. They're supposed to decide later this month, actually, Gil, whether they're going to take the case or not. They should take the case because there are two powerful reasons why the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision ending the John Doe was wrong. The first is a couple of those justices should have recused themselves. They had a terrible conflict of interest. Justice Prosser benefited by $2.6 million in expenditures from the very groups that weren't under investigation by the John Doe, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and Wisconsin Club for Growth. I mean, that's pretty disgusting. The other reason is the justices, the conservative justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, totally misread 40 years of Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court precedent on campaign finance, which was predicated upon there being no coordination between outside groups and candidates. So I hope the U.S. Supreme Court takes it. I think if they take it, actually, it might be a 5-3 ruling against the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Brad Schimmel, Attorney General, is against that, and he said one of his arguments was, well, the old law that said this was illegal is now a irrelevant relic, even though the relic is just 6 months old. I guess he wasn't an archaeologist. But anyway, the second case was that Gil mentioned was about Schimmel himself not releasing videotapes training when he was down in Waukesha County as district attorney, training videos for the police there, and the Democratic Party wanted release of those tapes. Maybe they got wind that there's something embarrassing on those tapes. Schimmel's super hypocrite on this. He's been making a reputation for himself among gullible journalists in Wisconsin as being very pro-open records. And yet here, when he himself is being asked to release documents under our open records law, he has refused to release them. And so that case was heard by the Wisconsin Supreme Court this week. And I think he's going to actually win because, of course, the state Supreme Court is rigged for conservatives who have a 5-2 majority. And even in the arguments, the now chief, Rogensack, was showing her cards, saying that basically, you know, why should we release these tapes? They're going to embarrass people and cause harm to victims whose names may come up in the videotapes. So that's where we stand on those two cases.
Thanks, Matt. Let's continue on for a moment with the phones. Robert's been waiting a while. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Well, observation about Donald Trump maybe using the Republican Party as a pathway to the presidency when he knows that institutionally, it's impossible to make it as a third-party candidate. And he doesn't have a whole lot in common with the traditional Republicans. He's more of some sort of populist. And they are, their policies are unpopular with the more knowledgeable public. You know what I mean? They're basically anti-worker, anti-common person, you know. And you know, it's kind of shrouded, like Paul Ryan's, always his economic plans are actually quite harsh, you know. And he talks about the periphery of the thing without the substance. And so they're trying to ride on the coattails of someone that's a little more popular, but they can't make it on their own, so they're using Trump, and Trump's using them.
Well, I think you've got your finger on something there, Robert, about the mutual kind of exploitation within the Republican Party now for those who just want power. And those are the folks
right.
Those are the folks who jump behind Trump right away, like Walker, once it was clear, or Robin Voss here in Wisconsin, once it was clear that Trump was going to make it. And Trump understood that he would have an easier route to be president through one of the established parties, and he understood early on that the Republican Party was going to be easier than the Democratic Party. He was quoted more than a decade ago of saying, if I ran for president, I'd run as a Republican because it would be so easy to take over that party for this. As to him being a non-traditional Republican, he's non-traditional in some ways, especially in his opposition to free trade. But he's very traditional, especially over the last 30 years, in his appeal to racism and in his anti-immigrant sentiment, and in his scapegoating. So traditional in some ways, non-traditional in others.
Yeah, and populism kind of takes on it's a huge umbrella. I always marveled that you had this billionaire, suddenly man of the people, right, who, you know, rose in the past, you know, decade on, you're fired. You know, you don't come up to my standards.
That, and he doesn't pay his workers. I mean,
right. I mean, his numbers of lawsuits against his various ventures is astronomical, and he's numerous reports of his welching on contracts, not paying contractors, and so on and so forth. We're getting kind of short in the hour, and there's a couple of other things I want to get to. One is, of course, Fighting Bob Fest is coming up. And Matt, you, in your years at the Progressive, you were central to all that. You play a role in, at some level currently. But that's coming up here in Madison on September 17th. Maybe a little preview?
Yeah, so there are events on the Thursday and Friday night at the Barrymore beforehand, too, which I want to talk about. So Thursday the 15th at the Barrymore, Greg Palast is going to be there with a new film that he's got, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, looking at the potential of theft of the 2016 presidential election. Interesting. Trump said it might be stolen, too, from the right, and Palast saying it from the left. Also, Green Party vice presidential candidate will be speaking on Thursday night, Ajamu Baraka. So for people who are listening who are into the Greens, that might be interesting for you. On Friday night, there's going to be the traditional kickoff event, except it's going to be films, excerpts from films. Divided We Fall, the film about the uprising here in 2011 by Catherine Acosta, a great movie. There are going to be excerpts from that, excerpts from Dirty Wars with Jeremy Scahill, and Jeremy's going to be in town, and a couple other films, including one by John Fugelsang, who will be there. Jim Hightower will be there, as he usually is, and Hightower will be there on Saturday the 17th, the traditional Fighting Bob Fest, now at Bree Stevens. Bree Stevens at Patterson and East Washington Avenue. Ruth Conniff is going to be presiding. This is co-sponsored by the Progressive and the Capital Times, which has traditionally co-sponsored and funded it. There'll be interesting speakers. Sarah Lloyd, who's running for Congress against Glenn Grothman. Sarah Lloyd, who has been with the Farmers Union forever and a terrific organizer. She'll be speaking. Scott Ross of One Wisconsin Now will be speaking.
Did I see Dave Zirin listed?
Dave Zirin is going to be a big draw, I think, especially after the Kaepernick controversy that he's been covering so closely. Fascinating discussion about patriotism and what it means to be a patriot and whether we have compulsory patriotism in this country that's supposed to value free speech.
I think he's one of the, well, certainly the most politically savvy sports writer, commentator, writing today in this country. Dave Zirin, I'm going to be out of town, unfortunately, but I'd love to catch my good friend Dave Zirin at Fighting Bob Fest.
I think, you know, he's one of the people I really want to hear. Kevin Alexander Gray, who's got tremendous politics, is going to be speaking again. He's written for the Progressive for years and years, used to head up the ACLU in South Carolina, ran Jesse Jackson's campaigns in South Carolina. A couple good representatives, Jocasta Zamarripa, Chris Taylor, they'll both be speaking. Keith Ellison from Congress will be speaking. So, you know, it's going to be a fun event, as always, and I hope people can make the event on the 17th. And also, if you're interested in those speakers on Thursday night and Friday night at the Barrymore, hope to see you there.
You know, we do have one more caller that wants to get in with a question or a comment. We got about 14 minutes left in the hours, so let's open it up. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I apologize in advance if I'm going to be sounding a little bit angry, but I've been trying to work on this issue for the last 15, 20 years, me and my brother, actually, and my question for Matt is, with the change of hands at the Democracy Now, or Democracy Campaign, will you be continuing to ignore the issue of global warming and climate change like your predecessor did?
Well, Mike, I don't ignore the issue of global warming. We do a lot of exposés about companies, fossil fuel companies, that are getting a lot of money and destroying our environment here in Wisconsin. So, you know, I've never ignored the issue when I was at the Progressive. I don't ignore the issue now.
You know, the other day you did this piece on Dean Knutson, this Republican assemblyman from Hudson, and his Talk about that a little bit.
Well, Wisconsin Democracy Campaign found out that Representative Dean Knutson up in the Northwest, up in Hudson, was forming his own PAC while he's a sitting legislator, which is just bizarre. He's got a campaign committee, though he's not running again. He's got a campaign committee, and he's setting up an own PAC. So if you're a legislator and you can now do this, it would just totally destroy any campaign finance limits that we have, because you could tell your billionaire friend, you know, don't give me the $1,000 that's the limit you could give me if I'm running for the assembly. You know, give me give my fund here $50,000 or $100,000 or $1 million. You know, and he called his fund the Wisconsin Liberty Fund. They always make up these really beautiful names for their own little kind of cash cows or little slush funds. And I'm reminded, maybe I'm dating myself, of the old movie, Woody Allen movie, Bananas, where Woody Allen says, you know, this is a travesty of a mockery of a sham. And that's what I view this allowance. If the ethics committee allows it to happen, it would be a travesty of a mockery of a sham. The travesty was the Wisconsin State Supreme Court decision. The mockery was the campaign finance rewrite last December. And the sham would be allowing this to happen on top of all that. Because, you know, you could have a so-called issue advocacy group and you don't have to disclose that your millionaire friend is giving $1 million to that issue advocacy group that you're head of. And that issue advocacy group then would be using that $1 million to say, you know, if I'm running against you, Al Ruff's the biggest scoundrel in the face of the earth. Call Al Ruff and tell him to stop being such a scoundrel. And so it's like giving me $1 million so I can use in a campaign ad. It would have the exact same effect. So we have filed a complaint with the Ethics Board, which is now replaced part of the Government Accountability Board, which is destroyed by the Republicans. And I'm going to go testify before that commission in October when they hear this complaint.
I did want to talk about, to change course just a little bit. You know, back a couple of weeks ago, Madison lost another longtime activist, Ruth Greenspan, who was a co-founder of the Gilman Street Books, the radical bookshop here in the mid-70s and so on. But she had a stint at the Progressive. Did your time overlap with her?
Absolutely. I was there when Ruth Greenspan was the publisher at the Progressive. I liked Ruth a lot. Really smart woman. She had that raspy cigarette voice of hers. She was very intelligent and very committed to left-wing issues. I mean, she dedicated her life, her adult life. She was publisher at In These Times, which was a thankless job. And then she ran Gilman Street Books for years. And, you know, she's one of these people, especially women, who over the last several decades have taken on the business tasks of running left-wing operations. They're not the glory jobs. You know, and they didn't get into the movement because they were interested in business. They got into business because they were interested in the movement and right. Dedicated their skills to the kind of the thankless tasks of keeping, you know, the lights on and the bills paid and payroll being met and fending off vendors, which has been an Olympic sport of the Progressive and In These Times. And so, you know, I haven't seen Ruth in Greenspan in years and years, but I have a very close friend who's kept me informed as to how she's been doing. I knew she was ill. Very sorry to see that she's passed on. I do admire what you do, Al, here in remembering people in our community, in our great left community here in Madison, and celebrating their lives and saying presente and having an event. There's going to be an event at the Cardinal Bar this Saturday from 4 to 6. So anyone who knew Ruth Greenspan wants to come by and celebrate the life of Ruth Greenspan, really one of the, you know, one of the foot soldiers in the movement for a better country here.
You know, she came from a remarkable family, from what I understand. Her dad was an organizer in the furniture trades and garment, all-around organizer in New York City. She grew up in Brooklyn, and the family had to flee, migrated to Chicago when, her father was his life was threatened by the bosses, and they came and he took up. He went on to Chicago to organize. So she spent a part of her early life in Brooklyn, then Chicago, and eventually migrated here. And I met her in the mid 70s We became dear friends, and yeah, I mean, she had a full life, 84 years old, but sorely missed. You know, we just got a few minutes left, and Michael has been waiting patiently on the line, so let's get him in, and then we'll head toward a wrap. Michael, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Alan. Just wanted to mention real quickly another concern I have if Hillary were to win that nobody seems to have brought up is that you'll get a package deal if you vote for Hillary. You vote for her and you'll get three scoundrels for the price of one. I mean, we'll have her husband Bill back. I'm sure that he'll want some position of power in any government of hers, and you'll get Chelsea, who, as I understand it, right now earns $600,000 a year as a consultant for NBC. I mean, that's great work if you can get it. But I think this country has had enough of being ruled by the Martha's Vineyard and Hollywood clique, as I call it, and we really don't need four more years of that. And thanks for taking the call. Bye.
Well, I do think Michael's put his finger on one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton is unpopular. I mean, a lot of people are offended by the greed of Bill Clinton especially, but it seems to be in the family there. And you know, Obama ran the first time on turning the page from the Clintons. Now we're turning the page back. And you know, for many people, especially a lot of young people, I think, you know, they don't want to turn the page back.
Any observations on Obama? You've mentioned President Obama, his current tour in Asia, the Asia pivot?
Well, I mean, the Asia pivot is a Pentagon pivot, which he has gone along with, as has Hillary Clinton. I mean, the Pentagon, before 9/11, we're going to have all this 15-year celebration and commemoration of 9/11. Before 9/11, the Pentagon had its eye on China. China was the enemy in view. China is still the enemy in view. Russia is kind of a little bit of a distraction, and the war on terror is a bit of a distraction. But still, U.S. foreign policy and military policy is geared toward a confrontation with China. And that's what the TPP is about, too, and that's what this visit is about. So, you know, Obama on the TPP, I think, is outrageous. He says he hasn't heard a legitimate reason to be opposed to it. I don't know, you know, who he's not reading, but there are plenty of reasons to be against the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement. Even Hillary Clinton has said she's against it. Bernie Sanders has been terrific about this and has promised to filibuster it. I mean, here we're going toward the end of the Obama era, and, you know, I admire the guy's personality. I admire his temperament. I think he's got a fine temperament to be president, calm, thoughtful, reflective. He was not strong enough at the beginning. He was very naive in thinking that he could persuade people by logic and charm and intelligence when the Republicans wanted to destroy him. He was not a left-winger or as left as some people thought he might be. I mean, he had Rahm Emanuel in there. He didn't fight the banks hard, and he didn't go for Medicare for all or even a public option. And he's been running the empire. That's the job. That's the job description of President of the United States. It's not to represent us. It's to preside over the U.S. empire and help out those corporations who are ruling the roost.
You know, a few weeks ago I had the wonderful emerita professor of U.S. history at Princeton, Nell Irwin Painter, on. And we talked about, because she's one of these historians who's been on this website created by Ken Burns, historians speaking about Donald Trump. And she made this interesting observation that I had to think about for that without Obama, there would be no Trump. Right? That again, we get back to that racist undercurrent and, you know, he was in the forefront of all that birther stuff and so on.
And also this fight against political correctness, which, you know, we're hearing from Speaker Voss, too, here in Wisconsin, is really an excuse to allow white guys to be as racist and sexist as they've always wanted to be, and anti-Semitic, too, if you want to throw that in. I mean, it's a way to say, you know, prejudice is okay. I'm sick of having to bite my tongue when I want to say something racist. And so to hell with you all, I'm going to vote for Trump because he's going to let me say it now.
You know, some years ago, one of the founders of the Black Panther Party of the 60s, Bobby Seale, was in town. And at that time, Even then, there was some of this sloganeering or disparaging connotations of, oh, you're politically correct. And he said something that I always remembered, and it's been a long time already. He said, I have one question to all of that. What the hell's wrong with being correct?
Yeah, I mean, this allowance for prejudice or this basking in your bias, which a lot of white guys want to do now when they go to those Trump rallies, and you see them with their Confederate flags, and you see them. I saw a Trump SUV with a Nazi flag on it, an anti-Semitic slur written on it. And you know, that's where we are now. And that really, that's what worries me most about Trump, that he's unleashing these really ugly forces throughout the country that, regardless of whether he wins or not, we're going to have to deal with for years and years.
Interestingly, part of an international trend, these right-wing parties, movements, demagogues all across Europe and so on. So it's and at that level, it's this kind of rightist recoil to neoliberalism, to kind of what's happening in the global economy, and so on. Matt, we got like less than 2 minutes left. Final word?
Well, I think you're right there. I mean, it is this xenophobia, this racism against immigrants is the natural offspring of neoliberalism, the natural offspring of this late era of capitalism that we're in that cannot take care of people. And doesn't allow people.
Oh, it refuses to take care of people.
No, but it's not providing people with a living wage. People are not able to get ahead. Their kids are not able to get ahead. People are naturally frustrated. And when you're naturally frustrated and you don't get a good alternative, you look to the right.
Well, again, I want to thank you for our periodic conversations on the air. You've been listening to Matt Rothschild with the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, regular contributor all over the place. I want to thank Pete, our engineer today, and Nancy out on the phones. I want to thank you, our callers, our listeners. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be back.